Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast Climbing in Heels is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Ding dong, Las Culturistas calling.
iHeart Podcast Awards 2023 Podcast of the Year, Las Culturistas, with SNL's Bowen Yang and comedian Matt Rogers.
There's stuff happening in 2024 that we really need to address.
Pop culture and huge guests, like the latest episode with
Dua Lipa.
The more I think about it, the more scared and nervous I get.
Listen to the newest episode of Las Culturistas with Dua Lipa and all episodes on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Las Culturistas to start listening.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Creature Feature, the show where we feature creatures. I'm your host, Katie Golden. I studied evolutionary biology and psychology. So today on the show, we're talking about some more human and animal psychology, biology, and behaviors. And I want to talk about how sometimes big things come in small packages, especially when it comes to the animal kingdom. Today we're talking the classic tale of David and Goliath, unlikely matchups with even unlikelier conclusions. Which of these underdogs will be top dogs in this dog-eat-dog world? Discover this and more as we answer the age-old question, what's the best way to roundhouse kick a wasp? And stay tuned, we have a special interview with Dr. Greg Pauly, curator, herpetologist, and snake whisperer. So, I'm sure everybody knows the story of David and Goliath, the scrappy little dude fighting and taking down a giant, but what if we got it all wrong? What if David was a giant-killing predator armed with a rock-slinging weapon? In the natural world, it's not always so clear who the true underdog in this situation is, and in fact, there's a little David-like spider who casts her own stones. She's called the bolus spider. The bolus spider group consists of several species of orb-weaving spiders native to America, Australia, and Africa, who hunt not just by weaving a web, but with a handmade bolus weapon. The human version of the bolus is similar to David's weapon, though instead of a sling, it's a couple of weighted balls tied to a cord, which when whirled above your head and thrown can be used to capture animals by entangling their legs. Bolus spiders use a sticky blob on the end of a line of spider silk. Their prey? Moths, which are often much larger than the spiders themselves. The spider will dangle her bolus out like a fishing lure, then swing it as the moth gets within her range. The moth gets stuck to the sticky glob of silk, and the spider reels it in. Even more sinister, that glob of sticky thread is often laced with pheromones that attract moths. The moths think they're about to meet a sexy single, but instead they meet their doom. One more thing about the bolus spiders. Some species have developed a pretty creative form of camouflage. They look like bird turds. Their lumpy, shiny white and brown abdomens are meant to mimic bird dookies, an unappetizing prospect for predators, and an unexpected source of danger for prey. So if one bolus spider says to another, "You look like shit today," she'll say, "Hey, thanks." So joining me today is Alex the Clam Schmidt, or as I like to call him, the Itty Bitty Schmitty Committee.
It's so good to be here, Katie.
We worked on those nicknames. We workshopped those.
It's like when you have two winners, you can't choose. Gotta do
can't
them all.
Can't choose, yeah. Gotta list all the names.
I also, when you were talking about the boluses, I realized that my touchstones for those kinds of weapons are David from David and Goliath and Batman. Those are my two main ways to go.
Yeah, the sort of or Wonder Woman too, those kind of ensnaring weapons with the swinging. Batman's got the Batarang, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's weird because he has a whole belt of stuff.
He's got a whole belt.
You never know. Yeah.
A utility belt.
He'll suddenly have a pager or something.
What a dork.
Yeah.
My favorite is in the old the Batman cartoons, like Adam West Batman, but the cartoon version, like he had anti-gravity spray in his belt. So as they were falling down a cliff, he just deployed that anti-gravity spray. So I actually have a video of the bolus spider if you want to take a look at that.
Oh, yeah. Fire it up.
Here she is. She's got her, you can see it. It's like, it looks like a fishing lure that she's just holding out with one of her legs. And she's like, you know, doing this kind of hither thing with it. And then shortly, a moth is going to just fly right into her trap and she'll reel it in. And it's just so funny because it looks like they're kind of fishing, just like do waiting for a moth.
Yeah, it's very Looney Tunes, like dangling a carrot on a string, and yeah. Bugs is gonna take it.
Yeah, like a Wile E. Coyote situation.
Yeah,
it's like it lifts it when when the moth is nearby, and there it snags it and then it reels it in.
Yeah,
and it's like the moth can be pretty big compared to the actual spider. So it's pretty, because like the problem with moths for regular spider webs is that, first of all, they're quite big. They can like, you know, tear a web, but their wings have all these scales on them that can like come off and allow them to escape a web. So
interesting.
Yeah. Because, you know, have you ever felt a moth? They're kind of dusty.
So yeah, a little bit. Yeah. That's also just anytime I think of an animal who eats moths, like they have completely the opposite moth opinion from me. They're like, you know what's worth all this effort? A moth.
A big mouthful of moth.
Oh, yeah.
Even saying moth feels, saying the word moth kind of feels like how having a moth in your mouth must be. Having that moth in your mouth.
Yeah, the moth, yes.
Yes. Well, so another story of a spidery underdog is the golden wheel spider. It's native to southern Africa. It looks kind of like a tarantula, but it's yellowish instead of black or gray. And you don't think of spiders as the victims that often, but they actually are. Like they have their share of predators who, and one of them we've talked about on the show before, it's particularly heinous. It's the parasitic spider wasp, which will, it's quite a menacing predator because they'll inject the spider with paralyzing venom. They'll drag the spider into their burrow. Then they lay their egg on the spider and bury it alive. And as the egg hatches, it'll eat this still living spider who's paralyzed slowly.
Just, oh my God.
Just over the course of even can be up to months.
And it's called the parasitic spider wasp.
Yes.
Imagine being such a parasite that parasitic is on the front of your name.
Right.
Wow. Like,
hi there.
No other qualities.
I'm Mr. Crimes. So, and actually, tarantulas and other spiders don't really have much of a defense against these wasps. They can't, because the wasps are aerial. They can fly. So it's really hard for them to, they just kind of try to defend themselves as best as they can. And they actually, because they're flying, the tarantulas do the technique of like predatory birds where they kind of ball up, but that just leaves them even more exposed to the spider wasps.
But the spiders got problems too, man.
That's true.
Never thought of
that. They got 99 legs and problems. Well, they only have 8 legs, but you know.
That's another problem. 91 more would help.
So the golden wheel spider goes full Sonic the Hedgehog.
Cool.
Where
it becomes too erotic in its movie version. Yes.
Oh God. It becomes too highly detailed and disquietingly too many muscles in its face. Yeah. They will transform into a wheel and cartwheel down dunes. And they can go up to 44 STPS, which is my term for Spidey turns per second. And they just, it's really funny to watch because they just they see the wasp and the wasp is attacking it, and the wasp can actually dig it out of its burrow. So and there it goes. Whoa. Just rolls down like Sonic.
And also the sand element makes me think of Sandshrew the Pokemon.
Oh really?
Looks a lot like
oh
that.
Yeah. Yeah, and it just tumbles down the dune side, down a dune, away from the danger.
Whoever shot this got a lot of coverage. This is like 10 different angles on that roll. I love it.
Drone footage of this spider. So there's another victim of predatory wasps whom I think we don't think of as needing sympathy, but the humble cockroach.
Oh, finally.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
cockroaches.
I do agree that they're gross. I personally have a very strong aversion to cockroaches, but they're still an animal. They got their own life and their own hobbies, I'm sure, or whatever they do.
Yeah. Do you have a lot of bug phobia?
Or not really.
Just these particular ones?
There's only really two insects that I'm phobic of, I would say, which would be cockroaches and silverfish.
Those are.
Those are the little gray ones that have a bunch of legs, and they're just, they're little, but they're just nasty. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I'm not even phobic. I'm not afraid of them. I just, they gross me out. But I don't mind spiders. There's not really many other insects that bother me.
It sounds like silverfish had great PR on that name. Right? They don't sound like they're silver.
They don't.
Fish are much chiller than bugs.
They really, they're not silver. They're just dirty little gray nasty things.
Yeah, the dirty bug.
The dirty bug. So cockroaches also face the predatory wasp. It's called the jewel wasp, which rides them like a cowboy, injects them with paralyzing venom, and then a neurotoxin that actually allows the wasp to hijack their brain and steer them towards their spiders or their wasp den.
Whoa.
And then like the spiders, the cockroaches become a meal for the wasp's larva, where they bury them alive, and then the larva slowly eats them over the course of at its leisure.
And it's called the jewel wasp?
Yes, the jewel wasp.
Yeah. That's another, because that sounds like some kind of fancy
they
lady.
They are pretty. They are pretty. They are shiny green.
I see.
And they kind of do. They've got curves. They do look like a fancy lady, actually. Hey there, fella. I'm Jewel Wasp.
Right.
I think they would be female, the ones that are predatory. So,
right.
I mean, certainly the ones that do this behavior because they're the ones laying the eggs. So they're like, hey there, good looking. You want to come to my burrow and have my young slowly eat you over several months?
Right, you got to be coordinated to inject whatever that poison is and hold one of those cigarettes
right,
on a long holder. Like
come
Gorilla
up
DeVille.
And see my din at some time. I've got some neurotoxins, baby. but first, so it chews the cockroach's antenna off, and researchers aren't sure why. Could just be to be a jerk.
Yeah, ruin their reception.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I get no channels.
The cockroach's dad is on the roof just fighting with it. It's more of an old tech reference.
Children, we used to get our TV through like wires that we put on our roofs.
Yeah, yeah.
And then when it stopped working, dad would get up on the war roof and swear a lot, and then he'd fall off the roof and swear some more.
Right.
That's how it was.
Being a dad was terrifying.
So it uses the remaining antenna to lead it to its den like a dog on the leash, and the neurotoxins have just rendered it completely docile, like a zombie.
Wow.
Then it buries the roach and lays its egg, and then it becomes like this zombie crib that also doubles as a larder for the baby wasp.
Yeah, animals are just so ready to use each other's bodies as like spaces, you know?
Yeah.
Like we're pretty brutal creatures ourselves, but we don't do a ton of that.
Right. Like, I mean,
we just don't bother.
I mean, you know, so like, all right, we wear the skin of dead animals and eat them, and that all seems pretty bad, but animals do it. I'm not saying that we should keep doing that. I'm just saying that animals also do that kind of horrifying stuff.
Yeah. I've never been like, that whale's going to be my house.
Yeah.
That would be crazy.
Yeah.
Not into it.
I mean, in Pinocchio, it looked pretty roomy. They got all the fish they could ever eat, too.
Well, you're very open-minded.
Well, so the cockroaches, when faced with this seemingly insurmountable odds with a predator that just has, like, neurotoxins and can turn it into a zombie, they just rear up on their legs and swing their back leg like a baseball bat and deliver a roundhouse kick to the wasp's head.
Oh, yeah, finally, roundhouse kicks.
Yes. And it's really, it's oddly precise how they can just, like, nail these wasps in the face. And they it's kind of funny, like, they just send the wasp flying.
Yeah. Where is it on the Van Damme scale, like 1 to 10?
9.5.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Missing points only because they don't, like, mug at the camera after doing it. So eastern honeybees, which are one of my favorite insects, they're, you know, cute. They make honey. They're not too mean. Sometimes they'll sting you, you know, if you provoke them.
Yeah, bees gonna be.
And these are found in Asia, and they will defend their hives by boiling invaders alive. Kind of like a medieval siege, anti-siege weapons.
Yeah.
So when an invader like a hornet gets into their nest, the honeybees are outmatched in terms of size, but they can work together to defeat their attacker in one of the most gruesome ways I've heard of. So they boil the hornet alive by dogpiling it and vibrating their muscles, which increases the temperature of this, like, little ball of bees that are surrounding the hornet until the hornet will boil alive at temperatures of up to 115 degrees Fahrenheit. And this, wow, this also increases the levels of CO2. So that, in combination, if the heat doesn't kill it, the levels of CO2 also will get it. And most of the honeybees can survive this. They can survive the hot temperatures and CO2 levels, but the hornet can't. So it's like they'll just kind of vibrate around this hornet and disperse, and there's like a dead hornet.
Yeah. Well, it would be kind of worse if the hornet could survive it, because then it's just endless vibrating just pile, like, and just a standoff. You
yeah.
know?
Like when you're on a real bumpy road and you get out of the car and you're trying to get your land legs and your eyes are just jiggling in their sockets.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is hornets and bees have something called an I see you predator-prey relationship, which is an actual term. I feel like biologists have the most adorable terms for things. So I see you is the it's when a something that is often a prey item will signal to the predator that it has seen it, and it's telling the predator, "Hey, buddy, I see you. I'm not worth your time." So it doesn't run away necessarily, and I think some species of squirrels will do this in response to snakes, where they, like, lift their tail up in a way that's saying, "Hey, I see you. You've lost the element of surprise, so why bother?" So the bees will do this. So when they see a hornet, they'll start beating their wings violently and producing this menacing hum.
Wow.
Like, "Wee."
So it's not, because the typical thing we all hear about is fight or flight. And this is some kind of dissuade them from fighting.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
I would say it's like towards the fight end of the spectrum, where they're saying, "We see you. You don't want our jiggly bee ball, do you?"
Yeah.
And then sometimes this will be enough to get the hornet to leave, because it's like, "I don't want to be in the middle of a big old vibrating ball of bees." Well, that sounds a little fun, but probably not if you get roasted to death.
It's like a theme park ride.
Yeah.
Like, if it were not safe, it would not be fun.
Right. Like Thunder Mountain jiggles you around a lot.
If it was built by bees to kill me, I would not ride it. But
just welcome to Bee World. We jiggle you a lot. So the kangaroo rat is another adorable little guy, which you would think is just a totally helpless piece of prey. They look like
kangaroo rat.
They look more like mice. They get their name not because they're in Australia. They're actually native to Western North America in semi-arid or arid areas like Arizona. They're adorable little mice-like things, and their hind haunches are quite muscular, and that's why they get the term kangaroo rat, because they kind of, you know, there's a little bit of that kangaroo-ness, and they can hop.
They sound like they would be a great minor league baseball mascot. Somebody needs to do that now.
The Kangaroo Rats.
Yeah.
Rah, rah, rah. Like a softball team.
You name. Want any regional animal with like one quirk, yeah. That's the best minor league baseball mascot.
The Arizona right Kangaroo there. Rats. Yeah, we're a lacrosse team. We demand to be taken seriously. So like the cockroach, the kangaroo rats will deliver a flying kick to escape the fangs of rattlesnakes. Their first approach is they try to leap out of the way of the snake strike with a reaction time of just a few fractions of a second. So they have very good reflexes and very muscular legs. They never skip leg day. Arm day a little bit. They got little tiny arms, but leg day. But if the snake actually manages to grab it, you think, okay, fight over, snake wins. But no, they actually will sometimes be able to kick the snake in the face and project itself out of its mouth before the snake gets the chance to inject venom. And it's really, really funny to watch. I'm gonna show.
I can't wait. And then it just kicks it away.
Yeah. So we're taking a look, and the snake actually grabs it and it kicks its head, and the snake goes flying, and it's really funny because its mouth is agape, and this video is in slow motion, so the snake looks like and that's
amazing.
Yeah, it's so interesting to me when you have an animal like what is more innocent than a mouse,
right?
But animals really want to live, and they will do their darndest to stay alive.
Yeah, it's like it even made sure, okay, if they bite me in the middle, my feet are in a perfect position to kick
right.
it in the neck.
Right, like,
great.
Right.
Good job.
He landed one square in that snake's face.
Yeah.
And it went flying. It's very funny. Because snakes, normally they look quite, regal isn't the word, but menacing. They look sleek and menacing, like killing machines.
Oh, yeah.
But a snake that's been kicked in the face looks very funny.
Yeah, you don't see a lot of, there was one time I was at a zoo in Ohio, and we were looking at the like monkey exhibit, mm-hmm. and one of the gibbon-type monkeys was swinging, misses the branch, falls, lands, and then like immediately gets back up and tries to look cool and normal. Snakes have like no limbs to make mistakes.
Right.
So they just always seem interesting.
Right. But if
it. Not here.
Yeah, if it gets kicked in the face, it's very goofy looking. It's like, I wasn't planning for this. Why?
Yeah. It looked like Rocky. It's like a shot early in the fight when it's not going well.
Right.
You know, and he's like, oh, good. And, you know, later it'll be fine. But
just slow motion, jaw waggling from side to side. So. Another little cutie who actually has a great strategy to defend itself against big predators are fieldfare birds. They're a small bird in the thrush family, native to Northern Europe and Asia. Their chicks make for very easy prey for ravens. They're bird babies. They're basically just little sacks of feathers and meat. So the fieldfare birds are smaller, and they really can't. Ravens are quite large, so they don't stand much of a chance against them using conventional warfare. But they use whatever.
They use chemical weapons.
Oh, they do, Alex.
Oh no.
They use whatever tools they have at their disposal. Their poop.
Oh, great.
Yeah. So. First, the birds sound the alarm, and that scrambles the birds. They like issue an alarm call, and all the birds in the area, the fieldfare birds, will start swooping and swarming the raven and try to intimidate it into going away. And if that doesn't work, this is how David Attenborough describes it: screaming with rage, they bomb the raven with their excrement. the duties.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because that name, like fieldfare, it sounds like a place in the Shire or something.
Yes.
Like I expected a very innocent bird.
Yeah.
So I was joking.
Yeah,
about
they look
weapons.
Innocent. They're like little songbirds. They look quite sweet and cute.
Of course they do.
And the duties stick to the raven's feathers, making it difficult to fly. So it's not just a gross out tactic, it will actually render them immobile. And in some cases, that could be fatal for the raven if they can't dry off in time. Makes them vulnerable to other predators.
Like an oil spill or something.
Yes, yes, exactly. Oh, boy. Spill on aisle 12.
Right.
It's just so, it's so interesting to me because, you know, you have this little tiny bird. What chance does it have? Well, it didn't bet on poop, did it?
That's so, I wonder how purposefully they're like, oh, I need to poop, but I should hold on to it as a weapon, just in case. You know?
I need this as ammo.
Because suddenly it has a purpose. You know?
Right, right.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that is very David and Goliath, though. Whereas literally slinging, you know, well, turds. yeah, it's the smaller the animal, probably the more creative they have to be in terms of how they defend themselves. Yeah. Like, be it with poop or flying kicks or,
right,
you know. I actually, you know, it's interesting because when I'm walking my dog as a, you know, smaller person of the female persuasion, like, you just got to be alert. I mean, everyone has to be alert at night.
Yeah,
but, sure. But, you know, it's just like, be alert. You know, I try not to be paranoid of everyone. But I notice, like, after my dog poops and I have that bag of poop, I feel empowered. Like, I feel like I have a weapon. I have, like, a morning star made out of poop. So I feel like if someone came up to me and meant bad, I would just throw the poop at them. And now I'm armed with poop. It's a good, it makes me feel safe. I think I understand gun owners now, except my guns would just shoot poop.
Yeah. And yours is all natural. So
it's all natural, 100% organic poop gun.
Top that Second Amendment. Wasteful.
Second Amendment, more like number two amendment. I'm no biblical or historical scholar, but I wonder how much bigger Goliath really was than David. Was he actually a giant, or was this a case of collective Alice in Wonderland syndrome? This syndrome, known as Todd's syndrome or dysmetropsia, is a neurological syndrome that affects visual perception. Remember in Alice in Wonderland, where our girl gets shrunken down or blown up, the world growing or shrinking around her? That's what sufferers of this syndrome experience. Either micropsia, things appearing smaller, or macropsia, things appearing larger, or even objects appearing closer or further away than they appear, a sort of mental side view mirror. The cause of Alice in Wonderland syndrome is varied. It could be a brain tumor, a migraine, a symptom of the Epstein-Barr virus, the cause of mono, or psychoactive drugs. I mean, we all know Alice was probably tripping her yarn balls off. The general cause is an abnormal amount of activity in the visual processing parts of the brain, resulting in increased blood flow to the area. So maybe David was sky high on shrooms? Probably not, although anyone who shows up to a battle with nothing more than a few rocks might be a little high. Hey, we'll get your rocks off, but first we gotta take a quick break. When we get back, I hope you have the stomach for it. It's gonna be about animals eating each other.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So, instead of getting Mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get Mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for Mom is Mother's Day, because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for Mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
and catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
We're about to discuss some animals who bite off more than they can chew, but first, do you or anyone you know have misophonia? It's the term for a strong aversion to the sound of chewing. I'm not talking being mildly annoyed by popcorn in the theater, but the sound of munching and slurping and gulping being enough for you to lose your appetite or even fly into a rage. For people with misophonia, chewing or other repetitive sounds can trigger the flight or fight reflex. Researchers looked at the brains of those with misophonia using fMRI and found that while listening to trigger sounds, there was an increased brain activity in areas responsible for emotions, long-term memory, and fear. The culprit? The anterior insular cortex, which seemed to spur this increase in activity. The anterior insular cortex is responsible for a variety of functions, including sensory processing, cognitive emotional processing, and even things like interpreting the meaning of one's own heartbeat, imagining pain, and judging how painful something is. If you think you may have misophonia, there's some good news. Cognitive behavioral therapy has been shown to help. And even better news, we're about to discuss an animal who doesn't chew at all. In fact, it likes to swallow prey items way larger than its own body, all without chewing. So, Alex, what are your opinions on chewing? Yes or no?
I do it. I've come across one or two people who I think have that misophonia.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'll be eating with them, and they're like, can you stop? And
yeah.
I'm like, stop eating?
My mouth can't be more closed than it is.
Yeah.
Like, chew with your mouth closed. Like, but my mouth has to open a little.
Right, right. Or I can just shove the food into my mouth like Wimpy from Popeye. You know, just burger, 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 all the way.
Well, if you did that, you would be like the black swallower, which is a fish.
It sounds like, you know, like the Black Knight from medieval stuff. Like,
yeah.
It sounds like the worst swallower in the realm.
Sounds like some kind of warlock who's like, it is I, the Black Swallower. What's your powers? I swallow the night.
Like, all the king's food, no! He's like, swallow, swallow, swallow. Wimpy, wimpy, wimpy.
So I'm going to show you, well, wait, actually first I'm just going to describe it. So it's a deep sea fish that can grow up to 9 inches, and it has a habit of eating things way bigger than its own body. It's found in deep North Atlantic waters at depths of 2,000 to 9,000 feet. So it's one of these spooky deep sea fish that are all bony and toothy.
Oh, they're the worst.
I know Alex doesn't like these, so I had to include it.
Yeah, they're all like, it's like if a Ziploc bag was angry. Like,
yes.
They're all like glowy and mad and hard to look at.
It looks like one of those stress balls full of the little like beads and stuff, but instead of beads, it's bones.
Yeah, and you can see all the organs somehow. It's just terrible.
Pumping away.
Yeah.
Everything's, all their blood looks black.
Yeah. Well, we should exterminate this species. Great.
Well, it gets even better, Alex. It has a distendable stomach that can hold prey twice its length and up to 10 times its mass. Its jaws can swing down and open large enough to eat things bigger than its own head, kind of like a snake. I'm going to show you a picture of a...
Oh, man.
So what I've just shown Alex is a terrible-looking fish, and its stomach looks like a water balloon, and it's full of... I think a squid, maybe. Yeah. Hard to tell, but you can still see. So the stomach can stretch, but it's so stretchy that you can actually see through it.
Yeah.
So it just looks like this big bag of squid attached to this fish that's otherwise pretty shrimpy looking.
Well, it looks like if someone told you, hey, I need a Photoshop of a minnow eating like a massive animal.
Yes.
And you didn't have a lot of time, you would just draw a big bag under the minnow with the animal in it.
It's
That's
like
what this looks like.
It's a child's idea of eating.
Right.
Sometimes its eyes are bigger than its stomach, so much that it accidentally kills itself.
Whoa. Just too much.
Yes.
Yeah.
So prey can burst its stomach, or more gruesomely, if the prey is so large that decomposition sets in before it can be digested, the decomp gases will force the black swallower to float to the surface, killing it. In fact, this is how most specimens are collected. It's just like... It's such a huge meal. They've just like, well, it's it doesn't have time to actually digest it, and it's so creepy. Like the decomp gases fill its body, and it's like, whoop, now I'm buoyant.
Yeah, well, and it's one of these animals that's just such a killing machine. It's dumb.
Yeah,
you know, like it just knows how to eat stuff, so it doesn't know how to not die. Amazing.
So here's a picture of one with its stomach just like torn open by a huge squid.
Yeah, a much bigger animal's just leaving.
Yeah.
It's like, well, see ya.
it doesn't, you're right, it doesn't look real. It doesn't look like this should actually happen.
Right.
But it doesn't look like a real stomach. It looks like a plastic bag attached to a fish where it's like, well, the food goes in here, I guess.
Right.
it's so creepy.
Like, draw a trout eating 200 pounds of beef.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just on the bottom of it. I don't know. Okay.
And its face is kind of doofy. Like, this one's dead, so that's kind of tragic, I suppose. But its face looks kind of doofy, like, well, I guess I boned this one up. So, Alex, on this show, we like to go to a little place I like to call Imagination Station.
Okay, all right. Toot, toot, on board.
On board. All aboard the brain train.
Toot, toot.
Toot, toot. Chicka, chicka. So imagine that you're just about to sit down and eat. What's your favorite food?
Oh boy. It's gotta be like a really good lemon pepper chicken.
Okay, so you've got your lemon pepper chicken and it's like inviting you to eat it. It's going, come here, Alex, come hither and partake of my succulent meats.
In my head, the little box of wings is talking.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, rah, rah, the lid, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just like, come here, Alex, we're delicious and covered in lemony zest.
Ah, they are.
And you open up your box of lemon chicken and you're bringing it towards your mouth, and all of a sudden, just teeth pop out of the chicken and bite you in the face.
I'm not going back to that Wingstop.
Well, you know.
Location.
I mean, Chipotle, am I right?
Yeah, that would be psychologically scarring.
Yes.
Especially for me, an intelligent animal.
Yes.
I'd be like, well, never again.
When your food fights back. Well,
yeah.
So I want to talk to you about such a case. It's this little guy called the Epimus beetle. They're only about a half an inch to an inch big as adults, and they look innocent enough. They're just like your average kind of semi-shiny green beetle. But they're called obligate role reversal predators. So the obligate part means that they must do that to survive. And the role reversal predator is someone who like pretends to be prey, and then when their predator gets close enough, they strike.
Oh, yeah.
Like sort of femme fatale, but they're beetles and acting like food.
Yeah, I just saw the first season of Killing Eve. It's when she's in that club down there and she lures the guy in. That's not a reference for people, but anyway.
No, but that's cool. So like she's kind of like luring someone. I mean, that is that trope
There's one episode where one of the detective people is pursuing her, and she purposely leads him into like one of those crowded, you know, like Euro disco kind of clubs, and it's just tons of bodies.
Disco.
And then there's
times.
A part where she just turns around and smiles at him, and you know that she knows he can't get away in time, and she's gonna get him. And then she does.
Ooh. Yeah. That's creepy. That is like this. That is so similar to this beetle, because it's just like once it's got its victim, like it takes its sweet time. It's actually not the adult beetle, but the baby beetles, the larva, that will do this behavior.
Whoa.
So the beetle larva will make sort of helpless prey-like movements like, oh no, I'm just a succulent little larva. Look at me, I'm so delicious and small. I bet I taste good. So it draws in predators like frogs. And as the frog's about to chow down on what looks like, you know, a slimy but satisfying larva, they dodge
the wing stop of the frog world.
They dodge the frog's attacks. Then the beetle larva bites the frog in the neck or underside, disabling the frog. It's just so gruesome. Then they attach themselves to the frogs and slowly feed off them, like just sucking out their juices.
Oh, like blood and stuff, just taking
it
out.
Just like, yeah, like they'll slowly eat at them, kind of like a parasite, but I think they work quicker.
Oh boy. Right, not like those lazy parasites.
Yeah. But she thought it was just a tasty little grub, but no, who's eating who now? That's my grub voice.
Because that's amazing, it's only the babies.
Like, yes.
Then the adults maybe see this brutal behavior happen, and they're like, so childish. You
know? Well, the adults are also predatory. They instead of playing the like innocent little baby kind of thing, they'll sneak up behind their victim, do a surgical strike, which some researchers think they're severing the leg muscles, which disables the frog and allows the beetle to eat at its leisure. Just like, they're such assholes. Like, just... why can't they just kill it and get it over with and eat it? But instead it's like, looks like you can't move. Isn't that a shame? Guess I'm going to have to eat your legs.
Man, and frogs are such a target for these guys.
Yes.
Poor frogs.
Well, it's frogs and other amphibians, like newts and such.
Well, newts have it coming.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, they're fine. I love it. What a specific brutal thing. Great.
I know. It's pretty metal, but it's also, it's just, there's something
creative.
So devious about it. Yeah, it's creative, but devious.
Yeah, like a murderous baby
in
any species.
Oh, that's such a creepy trope. Why do you think it is we're so creeped out by murder babies? You know, Omen. What's another like murder baby? Boss Baby. Was that the plot of Boss Baby?
No.
He murders a bunch of people.
I know an embarrassing amount about the entire movie.
I've seen it. I watched Boss Baby.
Okay, me too.
for this podcast once, there was a pilot episode that we didn't end up airing, but I watched Boss Baby for it. which was great. Good use of my time.
Then the makers of Boss Baby killed the show.
Yes.
It was too raw about it.
Boss Baby creators called us up and it's like, you don't understand. It's not lawyers. We will kill you if you diss Boss Baby. So it was a great movie.
Oh, yeah. But yeah, those things like The Omen or there's one called The Orphan.
Where
Twist, it's a tiny adult lady. But,
a tiny adult, yes.
Yeah, they do that a lot.
Yeah, like pretending to be... I mean, that's the whole Family Guy thing, is Stewie is...
Is a tiny larva who eats frogs. Yeah,
yes,
sure.
Yes. If the frog's name is Lois, am I right? That classic naughty Family Guy humor. That raunchy, naughty Family Guy humor. It's really good. So, Alex, I want you to imagine who you think will win in this fight. Although I feel like maybe the title of this episode is a little bit of maybe. But so we're in Maine in New England, where it's all snowy and beautiful. And we have two kind of elusive predators, the fishers and the lynxes. They're kind of like the sharks and the jets.
Fishers. Is that? I think I've heard of a fisher cat. It's, which actually might be a minor league baseball mascot now that I'm thinking about it.
We're the Fisher Cats, and we need to be taken seriously. Well, actually, no. Fishers are small house cat-sized animals in the weasel family.
Oh, nice.
Weighing in at only about 8 pounds. They're weasels, basically.
Cool.
They look like weasels. They're not... They're a little bigger than weasels, but they're about the size of a house cat.
Okay. Surely the much bigger lynx destroys it in every fight.
Yes, yes.
Because it's bigger.
Look at these. They're cute little noodle boys. And then the lynxes, the Canada lynx, which is a relative of the bobcat, but they're bigger and fluffier, weighs in at a shocking 25 pounds.
I kind of expected more. But that's big.
It's a lot of fluff.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they are very fluffy, but... Yeah, so they're a little bigger than bobcat. They look intimidating. They have a little more of the saber-toothed tiger kind of look. Fluffy, very sort of ice age looking. So, Alex, you dummy.
You think the larger animal, right? Idiot.
Well, researchers were pretty surprised to find that these little tiny noodly fishers were actually often the winners in fights between lynxes and the fishers.
Noodle boys.
Researcher Scott McLellan says a fisher really doesn't have any boundaries in the size of the animal it's willing to attack. Which is great.
Yeah. Now I need big fisher energy in my life. No, nothing's too big. No
BFE.
Challenge.
Yeah. Got some of that BFE. Yeah. They are saucy little noodle boys. And this researcher I love this guy because he has such a way with words. He also says, we know that fishers are very opportunistic. They're just a ball of fury. So they tracked lynxes with some radio collars, and when the radio collars stopped moving, they're like, I think that lynx might be dead.
Oh my God.
These are research. What's the accent like in Maine? Is that almost a Canadian accent, or is that not quite?
Oh, that's a good question. I haven't seen enough Stephen King adaptations.
I imagine it as Fargo, but I don't think that's right. But I'm going to go with a Fargo accent because, you know. Yeah. So they're like, oh yeah, we think that might be dead. The radio caller stopped a going,
right.
And they arrive at the scene where the lynxes were killed, and they have to do like a bit of biological forensics, they piece together the scene of the crime, and it's actually kind of hard because the lynx is often ripped apart limb from limb. It's a nasty, nasty scene. And they found fisher bite marks and tufts of fisher fur in the lynx's mouth, indicating that there was quite a fight. So it wasn't that, you know, it's like there's a chance that maybe the fisher was just like scavenging on the dead lynx. Like, no.
Yeah.
No, the lynx had defensive fight wounds. In fact, when they looked at the animal tracks, it pointed towards the fishers stalking the lynxes, hunting them down rather than just like defending themselves or getting in a little scrape. Like they are actively murdering these lynxes. Like, oh, I don't know, boys. I think we got a murder on our hands.
Right.
And according to Scott McLellan, who, God, I love him so much, quote, they just buckle on. They have a pretty powerful grip and they know where to attack. And after the fishers have killed the lynxes, they get a little Jeffrey Dahmer creativity. McClellan says, quote, it might drag a leg up into a tree. It might drag a leg into a bush pile or under some snow somewhere. Just like right. drag a leg. Here's a leg. There's a leg. Everywhere's a leg. Leg.
Well, because when you're in a creative project and you're in the early stages, you yeah. know, no wrong answers, no wrong ideas.
No wrong limbs.
Leg in the tree.
Leg in a tree.
Brainstorm.
Listen, we're just sticking things to the tree and see what stays in that tree. We're going to put some lynx body parts up the flagpole and see who salutes it. Also, fishers have these very spooky screams that sound, well, I'm just going to play a brief clip of this for you and see what you think. It sounds like someone's screaming, like yeah, a ghost just, person.
Right.
It's just, it's so creepy because I feel like if I lived in Maine and I heard that, I would just assume someone was being murdered.
Oh, because it's such a haunted state because of Stephen King.
Yeah, you know, like some yeah. ghosts are getting re-murdered. Oh, yeah, I didn't know. So Stephen King's from Maine?
Oh, yeah, he's all about it,
no
too.
No wonder.
A bunch of his stories are there.
It's
yeah.
the fishers screaming at night, yeah. murdering lynxes that scarred a young Stephen King.
Well, because especially these animals, they feel like something that would be in, there are a lot of Stephen King stories where it's like a horde of sort of small things being yeah. a problem, like Langoliers or something.
Yeah.
He would probably call it the Noodle Boys, and it would be these animals.
And yeah. then the Noodle Boys reared their heads and entered my body with their teeth. So we know that scrappy little Davids in the animal kingdom can take down Goliath, but I was wondering if there's any truth to this principle when it comes to human psychology, specifically in group dynamics. Human beings are social animals, so typically our Goliath-like strength relies on us forming groups, but can there be a downside? There's something called the bystander effect. It's a sort of groupthink situation in which crowds of people fail to help someone in need. Not because they're callously indifferent, but because each individual group member thinks, hey, someone else will handle it. Of course, who even deals with crowds of people anymore? We're all safe inside on our phones, browsing Twitter and Reddit or the TikToks and the Instagrammables. Well, not so fast there, my fellow millennials. A study by the Tavistock Institute of Human Relations found that the bystander effect was present even in online information sharing communities. When looking into how many people in online groups would respond helpfully to questions, the smallest groups fared the best, with the highest percent of responders. Medium-sized groups were the worst, and larger groups were better, but still not as good as the smallest group. The researchers speculate that while the smallest group avoids the bystander effect, the reason the larger groups tend to respond more than the medium-sized groups was due to the increased anonymity, reducing social inhibition. After all, who's going to remember your particular handle, WeedGoku69, if you're in a forum of 500,000 members, so it's safe for you to offer your potentially bad ideas. But when measuring the quality of helpfulness, the small and medium-sized groups fared better than the larger groups, so still, the smallest group won out in terms of how helpful they were and how often they were helpful. However, what the researchers didn't take into account is that if you have an anonymous intergroup small enough, 90% of the users could be sock puppets, with the remaining 10% being you and two dogs trying to lick the chicken grease off a keyboard. So maybe dogs on keyboards are the real heroes? We'll be right back after a quick break, and I'll be joined by Dr. Greg Pauly, who's here to dispel some reptilian myths and to talk about a very slithery David and Goliath story.
Mother's Day is coming, and Mom doesn't want flowers. She wants a cocktail. Here's a hint. Get Mom Bartesian. It's the countertop cocktail maker that creates your choice of over 60 premium cocktails in less than 30 seconds, each at the touch of a button. Flowers die. Happy hour comes back every day. So get Mom the machine that makes amazing cocktails with real fruit juices and craft bitters. Best of all, get $50 off a Bartesian premium cocktail maker with the purchase of one pack of cocktail capsules. So instead of getting mom a reason to fill a flower vase with water, get mom the easiest, fastest way to fill her glass with the floral notes of gin. The best cocktails are premium cocktails, and the best day to get it for mom is Mother's Day. Because you can get $50 off now for a limited time. Visit bartesian.com/mother to get the best premium cocktail maker for mom at the best price for you. Bartesian, premium cocktails on demand.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. New year, new name, new energy, but...
same old us.
And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. But that's not all. We will also have special guests to add their thoughts on the topics, as well as break down different political issues with local activists in their community. If you like to be informed and to expand your thoughts, listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Here with me today is friend of the show, Dr. Greg Pauly. He's a herpetology researcher and curator at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County, and he's here to talk to us about snakes. As the one thing I want people to get from this podcast is to love snakes.
That more. Sounds good to me.
Yeah. So snakes are notorious gluttons, and we're talking about today David and Goliath situations, so nothing is more emblematic to me than like a snake eating something huge in its little tiny noodle body. And it can unhinge its jaw and swallow prey many times its size. How do they do this without exploding, or do they actually explode?
They can explode. So first okay. I will say they don't actually unhinge their jaw.
Okay.
What's really interesting about snakes is that their jaw actually consists of three bones. So we think about like we have a mandible and a maxilla.
Yeah.
But what snakes do is they actually have another bone in between those.
Really? Okay.
In us, developmentally, that bone is part of our middle ear. But
oh, interesting.
In snakes, which don't have a middle ear, that bone is part of the jaw articulation. And so what they can actually do is they open their jaws really wide because of the fact that they've got this, you know, these basically two joints, this
right,
sort of
right.
three bone system.
Right. So
jaw.
It's kind of like a door hinge where it's like, you know, those top hinges in hotel doors that lets the door open pretty wide. Does that make sense? No.
No.
I don't totally know anything
lost.
About
it. Maybe I should spend more time at hotels.
No worries.
It's basically two hinges. It's basically the whole point is like two hinges.
So you have two hinges so it can...
And so it can open up, you know, in some cases, in some species of snakes, they get almost to 180 degrees.
Oh my God.
Which is, you know, pretty amazing.
Yeah.
So yeah, snakes, I mean, I think that they have this reputation sometimes as sort of being gluttonous, but you know, the reality is that, you know, a snake might only eat one or two meals a year.
Yeah.
So,
wow, okay.
I don't know. As somebody who's like... going to have three meals and maybe two snacks today. I feel like it's not my job to call somebody, to call a snake gluttonous when it's eating like once every six months.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's these unbelievable situations. So not
it's
all snakes do this.
Doing the CEO like intermittent fasting to a huge degree.
Exactly. So not all snakes do this, but particularly vipers and boas and pythons, some of our really like heavy bodied snakes, they take on huge prey items. So some of the biggest, what we call relative prey mass, is sort of what we refer to this in the snake literature, is some of those biggest numbers will be like snakes eating prey items that are like over 150% of their own mass. So I think the record is like almost up to 1.7 times their own mass.
Oh my
gosh. That's like, you know, imagine something like, let's take, you know, like a 20-pound boa constrictor.
Right.
That's like one of those snakes eating like a 30-pound meal. So it goes from being a 20-pound snake to being a 50-pound snake.
My God.
Because it just ate this massive meal.
Just get some terrible meat sweats.
Yeah, I would. And so that's right. I mean, so then what do they do for like, you know, the next couple of weeks is like nothing, you know?
Yeah.
They crawl over to some spot where they feel a little bit protected. Ideally, there's a little bit of sunshine, and they stick that chunk of their body that's got that big digesting prey mass out into the sun. And then it slowly digests. And, you know, weeks to months later, they take a giant poop and got rid of it all. You know?
That actually sounds like a wonderful life.
But there are these situations where, like, the snake kind of misjudged what it was trying to eat and actually eats something that's so big that it actually does end up tearing the inside.
My God.
So actually tearing the digestive tract, and in some cases actually causing the entire animal to rupture. And
my God.
There's actually this photo that went viral a couple years ago.
Yeah.
This is a non-native Burmese python in the Florida Everglades that had taken out a rather large alligator.
Yeah.
And it actually ended up being too large, and it ended up, you know,
how does it,
the animal, the snake sort of ruptured, and you can see the gator through the snake.
So how does it take out a gator in the first place? It kind of
constriction.
It's a constriction. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the thing. Like these species that we see doing this, like boas and pythons, are like really big, strong, constricting snakes. And then the other ones we see doing it are things like vipers, right? Where, you know, the snake strikes the animal, envenomates it, waits for that animal to die, and then goes and consumes it.
Yeah. How do they normally manage, like, without exploding? Because they must have some pretty flexible muscles to be able to allow them. Because, like, if we tried to eat something twice our size, like, that wouldn't work. We would instantly die or choke. Like, how do they not choke? How do they not always explode?
I mean, basically a snake is just this giant tube, right? And so if you can sort of fit into that tube, you're kind of good to go. Like there's a reason that a snake doesn't have a small neck in most cases, right? And it's because that neck would then be the sort of limiting factor of what you can fit down.
Right.
And so what's really amazing is like snakes have all these ways of sort of like being able to expand. So, you know, you don't see things like we have where we have like, you know, we have this rib cage that's fused in a few places. And so our rib cage doesn't expand that well. Well, snakes don't have that.
Yeah.
You know, they don't have a rib cage that fuses all the way around so that then it can expand a lot. When we see a snake, what we mostly see are like we see all the scales. But actually, if a snake is like eating a huge meal, then it's expanded so much that you actually see all the skin in between those scale rows. And it'll be almost as wide as the scale rows itself if it's really distended.
Yeah.
And so they can just take on these, you know, really big meals and their body can expand to accept a lot of it. There's, of course, limits, but even the stomach itself can expand lengthwise, right?
Oh, wow.
And take up a huge chunk of sort of that tubular body if it has a big meal.
And so,
or maybe not just like a big meal, but maybe, you know, maybe it's an egg-eating snake of some sort.
Yeah, so you have multiple ones.
Yeah, so maybe you just got lucky and you got, you know, you found the hen house and you just got, you know, six eggs at once.
Yeah.
And some species of egg-eating snakes actually rupture the eggs and regurgitate them, and some actually just swallow the eggs whole. So, like, for these ones that swallowed whole, he's got to pack in, like, you know, six,
do they poop the shell out, or?
It actually mostly gets digested.
Really?
So, snake stomachs are absolutely amazing. Like, you know, you see these snakes that, like, you know, take that big boa constrictor I was talking about. Let's say it does, you know, let's say it eats a small monkey of some sort.
Mm.
It's not pooping out little monkey bones. There's not, like, a femur that's coming out, you know, a mammal femur coming out, you know, 2 weeks later. No, that all gets, the snake stomach is so incredibly efficient. It digests all of that.
Oh, my God.
What you'll see in the long run is just see a little bit of hair, and that's about it. Maybe some claws off the feet and stuff.
I kind of want to change my funeral plans to being eaten by a snake, because then I would be 100% snake at that point.
Yeah, they actually have a pretty high rate of, you know, sort of recovering sort of the energy
so
from
efficient.
That animal. They're so efficient, yeah. I don't know. It's not that far-fetched. It's rare for a snake to consume a human. There are a few species that very, 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 very rarely do it.
Yeah.
And the key is you need to be a sort of a smallish person and
a really
big snake.
Yeah. So, yeah, if I turn into a little lady, then that'll be my funeral plan.
There you go.
Get a big snake. Big enough snake. So you wrote a blog post about these incredible flying wrestling matches between snakes and hawks, which sounds a lot more entertaining than anything out of the WWE. Can you tell us a little bit about it? Paint us a picture of this scene to our audience, and how are snakes able to fend off these hawks?
Yeah. So, I mean, this is a sort of, I think it's sort of a great David and Goliath story. Yeah. Like, you know, we have these aerial predators, hawks, eagles, other birds of prey, and they love to eat snakes. Like, it's, you know,
it's their tasty, Italian food.
Yeah, it's a tasty little meal. And so, but sometimes what happens, this is particularly true for juvenile birds of prey, is they haven't gotten their technique down, and they haven't maybe figured out that, you know, sometimes you can bite off more than you can chew.
Yeah.
And so you might get something like a juvenile red-tailed hawk, which is, you know, really widespread species of hawk across much of the United States, that might see something like a gopher snake, a bull snake, a rat snake. It's sort of those are the species that we often
see.
And
about how big are the snakes?
So,
and how big,
you know,
is the
hawk? This is a couple pound bird, you know, but it might, a juvenile red-tailed hawk still might have, you know, 2.5 foot wingspan. And then these snakes might be 2.5, 3, 3.5, you know, up to 4 or 5 feet long.
But they're just, but they're noodles, whereas the hawks
exactly.
have these
huge
talons, crushing beaks.
Yeah.
They can fly.
Yeah, exactly. Horrible, mean predator. And then there's this cute, adorable snake cruising around, just going about its business for the day, enjoying some sun. And this hawk comes out of nowhere and pounces on it. And so sometimes what happens with these juvenile hawks is they'll come down and they'll grab something like a gopher snake and they'll start flying off with it. But, you know, the snake is like 2, 2.5, 3 feet long. And so, and it's a constricting species. And so what the snake will then do as a defense mechanism is it just wraps up the hawk. Mm-hmm. And so here's this hawk trying to fly. And now it's got, you know, it can't move one wing well because like the snake wrapped a coil around that. It's like mashing kind of one talon into the other talon. It's got a coil around its neck.
It's like getting tangled up in a hose.
Yeah. And so what happens is like you'll see these reports every now and then. And this is like one of the great things is like people post this stuff on social media because it seems absolutely absurd. And it is, but it actually gives us an opportunity to study these sort of rarely observed events. And so what happens is you get these photographs every now and then that show up of like, you know, a hawk that has like landed in the middle of a street, or not even landed as much as it's like fallen out of the air into the middle of the street. Yeah. There's a hawk like wrapped up around, or there's a snake wrapped up around it. And, you know, nobody knows what's going on. And what's going on is the snake is fighting for its life.
Yeah.
And its last ditch effort is like, can I mess up this hawk enough that I can get away? And usually what sometimes happens in these cases is that actually the bird gets so exhausted that eventually the snake is able to crawl off and get away. You know, maybe it's got some talon injuries or something like that. And what's really neat is with social media is we see this now all over the place because people post these like absurd videos or absurd photos. But because they're posting these, you know, onto the internet, you know, we see observations of this like same sort of thing going down in like Africa and going down all across the United States and going down in, you know, other parts around the world, different species of, you know, birds of prey and different species of snakes. But we see that there's a lot of different snakes that are capable of sort of doing this as like the last ditch effort of like trying to save themselves and slay the evil hawk Goliath.
Yeah. So is that kind of a common behavior that they do where they try to wrap around a predator? But just in this case, they happen to be flying.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general, you know, I mean, a snake's first line of defense is like, don't get seen at all.
Right.
Rely on camouflage.
Stealth. Yeah.
Yeah. Rely on stealth. Try not to get seen. You know, the second line of defense is just flee. Right. To try to crawl away.
That's what they teach you in self-defense. Like the best thing to do is to run away.
Yeah. Don't get seen and then don't have any contact because you run away.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if that fails, then you got to try to scare off whatever it is. And, you know, and so there's snakes have all these bluff displays.
The rattlesnake.
You know? Yeah. And other snakes will like try to rattle their tail to kind of mimic a rattlesnake, or they'll hiss, or they'll strike at you, but like totally in ways that are never going to connect. It's just these defensive strikes.
Yeah.
And they do all this stuff to like, you know, they inhale a bunch of air to look big, you know, they do all this stuff to like scare away a potential predator. But if that fails as well, then you've got no other choice but to fight for your life. Right. Yeah. And so that's what's happening. I mean, this is a snake fighting for its life. The hawk is fighting for a meal. The snake's fighting for its life. Yeah. The snake's got way more to lose.
Yeah.
Gives it all it can, and sometimes it works.
That's
amazing. But then you have to imagine, like, in these situations, like, that snake is probably, you know, snakes have home ranges. They have territories.
It's just dropped off in the middle
of
nowhere.
So now it's dropped off in the middle of nowhere. So I think, I forget the exact street, but, like, the blog that I was writing about was literally, like, a guy was driving down the street and took this photograph in, I want to say, like Echo Park here in Los Angeles, of this red-tailed hawk that just plummeted down in the middle of the roadway with this snake.
Yeah.
And so sometimes it can be as like conspicuous as a spot as that. But of course, that snake is now, you know, totally in a new habitat. It has no idea.
Got to rebuild its snake life.
It's got to totally rebuild its whole life. But at least it's alive.
Yeah.
You know? At least
yeah.
it made it. So.
You got to try it. I wish that... that I think it's the Mexican flag that has the hawk and the
yeah,
snake.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
It.
Yeah,
they should replace it with a snake just totally wrapped around the hawk and like just battling it out.
Yeah, doing That'd its be amazing. Very best to survive. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. If there's one thing you could ask people to do to appreciate nature more, what would it be?
Oh, since we're talking about, you know, sort of rarely observed things, I would say, you know, if you see something out there that's really bizarre, you see a snake and a hawk crashing to the ground, you see some lizards mating, you see, you know, there's probably other cool stuff going on in like non-reptile examples, but, you know, you see something interesting, take a photograph of it and send it to somebody at your local natural history museum because maybe it's actually scientifically interesting. Or better still, download this amazing app called iNaturalist and participate in this online citizen science project where you can upload observations of things that you see and share those with people around the world and create an amazing digital legacy of biodiversity records that scientists for literally hundreds of years will be able to use for their research.
Yeah, and then you could maybe also use it for your new metal band album cover. But
absolutely.
But share it with scientists first, please.
Yeah, and then we can even give you advice on like,
yeah,
you know,
what to
this
name.
Is, yeah, what's a good name, what's going on, what's the
correct scientific name of your metal band.
Yeah, and then you can have a Latin-influenced metal band.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And we're back with Alex Schmidt. So that was a pretty snaky adventure.
Yeah, I don't know why so many people are afraid of snakes. They've mostly been like comedically hit and in weird fights with birds, and I'm way into it.
I know. I do like snakes. I think they're actually kind of, well, I guess rattlesnakes aren't cute to me just because I associate them with venom, deadly venom. But the other ones are cute to me, like pythons. They kind of like have little puppy faces. They're cute.
Yeah.
They're little noodle dogs.
Yeah, that Disney's Robin Hood movie where the snake is like a doopy advisor.
Yeah.
You know, that's the one that got it.
I had a lot of sympathy for that snake.
Yeah.
You know, he was like...
Like, yes, your highness.
Yes.
Like a lot of that stuff. Oh, really good.
He was sort of
really
like
weasley.
The Dwight Schrute of the...
Assistant to the False King.
Yeah. That was the Disney hit, Robin Hood. An animated tale.
Yeah, for where he was a fox.
Yeah, remember, that's a good...
Like in history.
Yeah, yeah, in history, Robin... I don't know if you guys knew this, but Robin Hood was a fox.
Yeah.
That's a great movie. I love all... Just like, they have Little John as Baloo the bear somehow. It's like a big bear, and it's the same voice actor as who did Baloo in Jungle Book.
Yeah, that brief period of reusing a lot of the cells, that was a good time. Yeah.
I think we need more positive representation of snakes in media. I can't think of, like, any good snake. Like, can you think of one, like, a good cartoon snake?
Oh, boy.
Oh, wait. Kung Fu Panda, one of the snakes is one of the good guys, one of the good fighters.
Yeah, good.
And she's a female, which is... I don't know why I called her. I'm used to calling animals females, but she's a woman in the movie because she's anthropomorphic.
And maybe that's why they're not in a ton of stuff, is that it's a little hard to make them anthropomorphic in a super fun way because
right.
they have no limbs. You know?
Although I did find, I mean, like what they did in Robin Hood, again, hit Disney film Robin Hood, the animated tale of Robin Hood and his merry men.
Historical documentary.
Yes. Is like the snake would like fold his fold his body in kind of like funny ways. And like, I think you can definitely do it. Just gotta have empathize with those snakes.
Yeah, a little creativity.
Give us more good representation of snakes, please. They're great. They're good. They're good little noodle boys. we need fishers and snakes. Who do you think would win? Fisher versus snake, big snake.
You know, that's almost the existing story of Rikki Tikki Tavi.
That's
true.
That is true. Rikki Tikki Tavi is a mongoose.
And there was an
snakes.
Animated movie of it that our library had on VHS.
Yeah,
and
I remember that
a lot.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like a Chuck Jones movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that story is accurate because mongoose do eat snakes.
Yeah.
And often poisonous ones. And they'll eat, or not poisonous, sorry, venomous. And they'll also eat scorpions. They have a certain resistance to scorpion venom.
Tough little noodle boys.
Tough little noodle boys, yeah. Or would it just, like, if you matched up a fisher with a snake, would it just be like flopping two noodles together? Like a fight, like fighting with two pool noodles.
Right.
You know, pool noodle fights sure. that you have. So, Alex, you got anything to plug?
My upcoming pool fight is going to be... the Cracked Podcast. I hope people check it out. And then I'm doing a show... in LA, Friday, July 19th, if that fits with when this comes out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's at Stories Cafe in Echo Park. It's called Difficult to Name, and it's a great reading series.
No, what's the show's name?
Difficult to Name.
No, just come on. You can do it.
Difficult to Name.
Alex, you should come more prepared to these podcasts.
You were so ready for that bit. That's what happened.
yeah, and I was actually just on the Crack Podcast, so that should be coming out soon. Probably around the time... Well, when is that coming out?
It'll be middle of July.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Sweet.
So it's all coming together.
It's all coming together. It's all all the way to the top. It's all coming together.
Yeah. And you brought great stuff, including animal stuff. So, it's great.
Yeah. We talk about extinct kangaroos. Or are they?
What? Tough little kangaroo boys.
So where can people find you, Alex?
I'm at Alex Schmitty on Twitter, and then my website is alexschmitty.com. And it has an email newsletter I do where it's 10 tips on fun things that are free on the internet.
How am I not subscribed to that?
I think I don't talk about it enough. I've been trying to.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm going to subscribe to that. I want Schmitty tips.
Yeah. They come like once a month, unobtrusively.
The gritty Schmitty.
I feel like the room will fill with nicknames the more we are here.
I invite everyone on Twitter to hound Alex with your own nicknames.
Oh, do it.
You, of course, can find us at Creature Feet Pod on Twitter, FEAT, creaturefeaturepod.com, Creature Feature Pod on Instagram. We're up here every Wednesday, and I'm at Katie Golden, and of course, I'm also at Pro Bird Rights, or... Is the bird me, or am I the bird?
I'm just thinking about that bird that poops on its enemies.
I know. It is truly an excellent strategy of bombardment. Birds is nasty. They nasty.
Listen, birds.
Stop! Don't be nasty. So nasty. You nasty. And thanks to the Space Cossacks for their awesome song, Exolumina.
Oh, hi, I'm Rachel Zoe, and my podcast, Climbing in Heels, is back and better than ever. You might know me from the Rachel Zoe Project, or perhaps from my work as a celebrity stylist. And guess what? I'm still just as obsessed with all things fashion, beauty, and business. Climbing in Heels is all about celebrating the stories of extraordinary women, and this season is here to bring you a weekly dose of glamour, inspiration, and fun. Listen to Climbing in Heels every Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Ding dong, Las Culturistas calling.
iHeart Podcast Awards 2023 Podcast of the Year, Las Culturistas, with SNL's Bowen Yang and comedian Matt Rogers.
There's stuff happening in 2024 that we really need to address.
Pop culture and huge guests, like the latest episode with
Dua Lipa.
The more I think about it, the more scared and nervous I get.
Listen to the newest episode of Las Culturistas with Dua Lipa and all episodes on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search Las Culturistas to start listening.